you just want to add a few points for emphasis. And first talk a little bit about the double pulsar again. And, well, I think you already showed this figure. And just to make the point, that there are really two different ways of forming double hydrogen star systems. This is exactly the picture, going back to Van Orbingtown, where you have first supernova, and then later a common envelope, and then the second supernova. Some people don't like this. Larry Brown would be one of them. And the reason for that is, in this case, you have a neutron star starting inside the massive envelope, common envelope. And it's not entirely clear whether the neutron star will survive as a neutron star. Brown and Colgate and Fryer, they have all argued that you get into a regime of runaway accretion and that you actually form a black hole.
What kind of mass black hole would you form from something like that?
Pretty massive.
Not in the Brown Baker theory. But...
Yeah, gotcha. Why not?
Because this was all in the context of very soft equation for states where the neutron star would accrete just a tiny little bit and be turned into a 1.8 solar mass black hole.
Right? Sure, but it would continue to accrete in this case, right? Because you still have all this this mass. I mean, it's true, the minimum mass for the black hole is very low.
It's not so clear.
But if with the maximum, I mean, Fryer's old work had shown that if your maximum neutron star mass is 2 or 2.2 solar masses, then you don't always accrete that much. It depends really what star.
Well, but if you're really talking about mass of star, I mean, we're talking about envelope masses of 10. So it's clear, I mean, it really depends on how much mass you have. If you make it with a low mass envelope, then it's certainly not clear.
But even with a high mass envelope, sometimes you can actually release enough energy because the envelope is very puffed up to eject it before the neutron star accretes, one solar mass.
I think this is also pretty open.
It's certainly not clear, but I think
I don't want to take sides here. I just want to point out that there is an
argument.
And I would say at least one of the fine also, I think, has good evidence for having survived from the envelope.
And that's important in the context of clusters, of course. We have this problem also that neutron stars will often collide with ordinary stars where they again find themselves in quite a bit of gas, and the same problem, and as far as I know, it's still an unsolved problem of figuring out what might actually happen to this neutron star. Yeah.
And in that case, naturally, it's even more interesting or worse problem depending on your view, because in globular clusters, we're hitting quite dense, low mass main sequence stars often. Mm. So the actual environment around the black hole, or the neutron star, could be quite a bit denser than in the case of the giant. So in fact, it could be more likely, even in the globular cluster case, that you drive high envelopes.
But on the other hand, if you have a collision with a low-mass giant, there's not that much mass in the envelope.
No, but you're colliding with between sequence stars much more often than a giant. So the density of gas around the neutron star is higher, and that will help you, as I understand it, right, to drive a higher n-dot. You think about the Chevalier argument, and Roger Chevalier would tell us in this case you don't have high n-dot, but in the main sequence case, it's dense and you do. Mm-hmm.
So this is one of the reasons why Jerry Brown suggested this alternative model, where you have stars that are very similar in mass initially, and you get the common envelope phase before even the first star explodes in the supernova. So in that case, the neutron star never sees the massive envelope. Now, an important point to relate to what Vicky said earlier, of course, is that, and raised by you before, is that you can get a kick from the first supernova. In this case, the kick can't be large, because the unbound system, and most of these systems are actually unbound, you can hang up with the tail anyway. But in this case, you could happily live with very high kicks.
Yeah.
Irrespective of what happens, I guess. Now, Vicky already showed the detailed statistical analysis for the double pulsar, and this is sort of a summary of this. Why I think it's a low kick and probably you capture supernova. And it's really, if you look at it, it has a low eccentricity, which is something you don't expect if you have a high kick. It has a low space velocity, And I think very important, because that helps you distinguish between the various other things, is the spin of pulsar A's aligned field. You expect the pulsar A is the one that was spun up by accretion, and you expect that accretion would align the spin with the orbit. And if you don't have a kick, the orbit axis and the spin axis will not be changed by the supernova. If you get a random kick, then you would expect a change. And there's one other feature, and that's the mass itself. 1.25 solar masses, and that is also the mass you expect from the capture supernova. In fact, you can even go further. You can even use that in principle to measure to test the equation of state of the neutron star. And the point is that if you have an e-capture supernova, this equation is very critical density, which for a given composition can be translated into critical mass. And that critical mass of the core before it explodes is 1.37. Now, if, as I said earlier this morning, it's believed that most of that core collapses, and if you that now collapses to the 1.25 solar mass we observe now, you get a direct measure of the binding energy of the neutron star. And you can use that to test the equation of state. The big caveat, of course, is you don't quite know how much mass is really, or how much core mass is really injected in the explosion. But the younger triangle estimator would say it's a few times 10 to the minus 3, and almost certainly not more than 10 to the minus 2 solar masses.
Can I just, I hate to remake that point, but the previous slide, so I know what you, I mean, the system has low eccentricity and low space velocity, and that is consistent with the low kick. But having just that, it doesn't mean that you need a low kick.
No,
but the first two statements that once we see that, all the system must have gotten a low kick.
I'm just saying that there's really these make it very consistent.
So is it correct that the stuff you showed, Vicky, didn't take into account the spin alignment or the low masses, extra pieces of information to?
We did take into account the spin tilt and the mass of the pulsar, etc. And you can still explain it with, you know, more massive projectors. I mean, you cannot exclude the massive projectors.
But anyway, the other point I want to make at this point here is that this is a critical mass, and that's the prediction of e-capture supernovae. There may be some small variation, but it shouldn't be huge. And so if you can determine the mass of the neutron stars in proper clusters, of course, they have the critical mass, then it doesn't help. But that's another good signature.
Explain to us again why that low mass is expected and how firm that is.
For a given composition, taking degenerate core, we need a critical density of 4 × 10⁹ grams per cubic centimeter.
That's well established. That's just nuclear physics.
Yes, that's just nuclear physics. So it depends. So that estimate depends on basically on nuclear physics. It depends, it also depends a bit on the composition. Mm-hmm. But in the error bar, we sort of put that in. So this error bar actually includes our estimate of these uncertainties. What it does not include, however, is this.
So how different is your final neutron star mass electron capture weight compared to ion core weight? If you take people's best models for regular supernovae, how do they?
The main difference is for the high core neutron stars can have masses as low as this. They can also be lower than that, in principle, because the transiting mass for iron is actually quite low.
And that just depends on the composition, right?
Yes. But if you look at the neutron star distribution, you see a few systems like this, at the 135, and then the other region stars that have a much lower distribution.
Except from stellar models, once you need a massive enough star to get to Orion, and then that then you end up with
massive stars. Exactly. Right? That's why you probably don't want these very low region stars on my program, if you could. That's probably the same region too. So assuming you keep a calculator to find the masses, they get masses significantly bigger than something.
So I see a no rotation exclamation mark there. Rotation are changing by what, 10%?
Rotation could change by much more.
Really?
Yes. Oh yes. I mean, if you really have predicted rotation, okay, anywhere close to predicted rotation. But we don't expect them to be rotating.
But rotation would certainly change. And the expectation that they're not rotating fast is because you think?
Yes, in white dwarfs at birth are slowly rotating and so on. It's not only the magnetic fields. You also, of course, you accrete a lot of mass during the evolution of the giant GB phase, and that will all be low elementary material. So that itself will slow down your core significantly, even without magnetic fields.
What are typical spin periods for white
dwarfs? I don't remember. Mm-hmm. Are they alone? They're alone. I mean, certainly. I mean, to have a significant effect, you want to have two. You want to have rapid rotation and differential rotation. Solid body rotation doesn't help you all that much.
But that might be 10% at most.
That could be.
And the, of course, the equation of state. That's another almost factor of two, right?
This is the equation of state of the progenitor. It's also near magnesium cores.
No, but then the final mass energy of the neutron star, of course, is equation of state dependent. That's another.
Yeah, that's what we want to test.
Right, that's a significant range. If you go from the softest to the stiffest equation of state.
We did this sort of and looked at a huge range of equations of state, and that's one of the biggest. The constraint is consistent with equation of state people like.
Right, so for, I actually don't understand how you go down so much from 1.37. Unless you're looking at very soft equation states, I can't read your labels.
Well, I didn't want to discuss that anyway, but perhaps we'll discuss it later.
Sure.
Okay, that's it. Yeah. The other thing is something we already showed, is this somewhat puzzling correlation observed by Faulkner between the eccentricity of the W-region star systems in the spin period of the pulsar, which is something you don't expect if you have large peaks and random distributions. And this is what if you showed this in the baby, but if you make the radical assumption that there are no peaks, you get something without fudging that looks more like what you observe. Now, one shouldn't take this too seriously, because as we also showed, there are certainly two pulsars, 1913 and 1534, both of which almost certainly have large kicks. And in particular, both of them show this geodetic precession, which means is that the pulsar A is not aligned with the orbit, which I think, again, unless you do something funny about the accretion process, strongly suggests that there must have been a kick at the time of the second supernova. So I think we agree on that. There's no one solution that fits everything. And also, I think the masses in these other systems are actually quite high, and much higher than the electron masses.
The neutron
stars,
they are higher by 0.1.
Yeah. solution solved. I think that's actually all I would need.
I'm just curious, actually, sorry, quick question. What are the squares rather than red triangles in the previous one as well?
That probably wind produces these. Those are systems where the evolutionary history suggests that the helium star did not fit the helium structure of those
smaller systems.
It's also not clear why they should be doing should fit.
And the two systems that you said had they kicked the nuts on the spot, is that right?
They are.
And the one at 0.6 is 1915, the top triangle.
So if you take those out, then the relation also is clear. Of course, one point, again, which Vicky already mentioned, which a fun lab always makes, it's surprising that you have so many angular eccentricities, but then.
So long age average, are they allowing for the fact that you see the fast spin periods for longer and of course there's the evolution of time? Or is that for?
No.
They're not age average.
This is after evolution, this is the present day, this is birth.
But similar, for fitting individual systems, not the ensemble age average.
No. Is there any concern about selection effects in the sense that the very high eccentricity pulsars are going to have more pulsar acceleration in the orbit, and that'll make the pulsations harder to actually detect?
It's not taking into account, but I don't think that possible people would say that that's a strong effect for the dopamination systems. There is another effect, of course, that the high eccentricity systems decay more rapidly.
But you've got this in here, haven't
you? But that's the difference between the top and the bottom.
And that was the main point in Chorazi and Bates.
So that you can see that effect, but not it's not strong enough. But I would not take it anyway, I wouldn't take it too literally.
I'll face
that. It's an interesting part.
Is there any reason why, so what's the same? If we believe this low velocity and you say it's the electron captures supernova, is always the second neutron star. Is there a reason why that might be the case? I mean, why would there always be electron capture? It's just the mass ranges of what we produce.
Would contradict 1534 and 1913.
Yeah, certainly from a priori point of view, you would expect both.
But is there any reason why you would get relatively more e captures on the planet? Is it just the mass range of the sun?
Well, it could just be the initial mass range. You sound a different initial mass.
Yeah.
And you're favoring the lower masses.
Because you're also presumably. When you mentioned that, someone mentioned that this morning, you're actually increasing the mass of the secondaries off in this case, which is kind of the evolution.
Now, I think there could be a tendency to have more of those guys. But you shouldn't, but it's not that good. I don't think, I certainly don't believe that these two are interpretable. So, but quite a few others.
Natasha. So going back to the basis, so if you will try to explain the neutron stars and global clusters with only coconut supernovas, you will run to the obvious problem of too high case. And so for different vitamin cities where mass ranges where you can form neutron stars are just really different. What it gives to you is that if you have a low metallicity, you form just a little bit more coherence than neutron stars. So then you place those neutron stars and ask yourself how many grams will be retained in the global cluster. And so here I'm just putting the fraction of those neutron stars, assuming that the escape velocity from the place where they've been formed is from 0 to 100. And also considering only neutron stars formed from a single population, and considering that all of them are usually in binaries. In the case where you have only single stars, the retention fraction is very, very low. So for escape velocities which will be normal for a typical dense cluster, it's below 10 and minus 3. And it is high in case of coccodops, neutron stars, but still it doesn't give you too many of neutron stars being retained. Basically, the numbers are such that you form about 3,000 neutron stars. In a single case, you retain from 1 to 2 neutron stars per cluster, and in case of binaries, 10 to 15. In case of all cakes, up to 9 cakes, which had a distribution with a low velocities, then you could retain more, well, but still not extremely more. Okay, so now we go back to the electron capture supernova, which became a main channel of production of neutron stars and was very popular. Again, the mass ranges are a bit different for different metallicities. The mass range is pretty small. If you go just from normal stars, it's more smooth out for binary stars. It also can come from accretion-induced collapse and from Irving-induced collapse. Well, those ranges, I don't really remember. I haven't put my reference in paper, but the point is that in different papers which I looked at, the difference between masses was about half so mass, but the initial mass was shifted when you could have it. It doesn't really give much of a difference. My best example, already mentioned here, is that the well-known crop supernova is actually most likely an electron capture supernova. And cakes from them are assumed to be not less than 100 kilometers, and in simulation which I show you now, we actually assume that it will be 40 kilometers. So if you consider the whole population, look now on the retention fraction of all neutron stars formed through both channels, then you find that in case, if you take into account an electron capture supernova, your retention fraction actually goes up to 10% almost. A typical global cluster will have a couple of hundred of neutron stars retained, and a global cluster like 47 TAC, which is pretty massive, and have an even bigger escape velocity, will have about 1,000 neutron stars. So going just to numbers, just to show you what will happen. So this is a just a formation with different metallicities. It's how many you form, it's about 2,000. It always go down with the metallicity in a completely different direction from what you want for the binaries. This is for different just cell evolution channels from single stars. This is for binaries. This is all not including any kind of dynamics. It's just a straight field population. And what happens in case of dynamics is that even if you start with 100% of binaries, you will destroy some of them. So as a result, your production for coccodops supernova and for star evolution electron capture supernova will be somewhere between the single stars and the binary stars. So here I'm just giving the numbers for retained. This is for accretion-induced cutouts and for merger-induced cutouts.
But why does that look completely independent of metallicity?
Sorry? The coccodops. Yeah.
No, the part at the end.
Maybe I just...
Is that just a mistake?
Yeah, just...
Okay.
No, it does go down.
Okay.
I'm sorry, I will not be able to make that. I'm just starting with the
So what are the up there, the different columns are what? The first one is...
So this is a collapse. This is from... from stellar evolution. This is accretion-induced collapse. Yes. This is merge-induced collapse.
And the retained is how many do we retain?
So here are retained. So this is
assuming.
This is not assuming anything. This assumption of retention is here on Mabu for retained is certainly here on the four collapses. Nothing is given for other channels. The retained numbers are in here.
Okay.
But just to be clear, most of them are like, especially if you focus on that, most of them will be retained.
Really high, but you still
what
put in some K-classic distribution?
Yeah, 40 kilometers per second.
Yes, so what heat distribution do you assume?
I assume 10th of hops. So I'm just giving the Gaussian
the distribution.
Yeah, just to give some distribution. And we know nothing, right? Yeah.
Is the increase in merge-induced collapse with metallicity significant, or is that just really?
No, it's... I mean, you can say, oh, there's some, but...
So why does the accretion-induced collapse depend on metallicity?
I think it's because of mass series, something about this inside of stars. Okay, so when we go again and look on this picture, then figure out that the most of the retained heat will cost will be kind of actually from different, from captured supernova channels. So compared to the field where you have only 1 in 6 Michelin stars from captured supernova, in the normal cluster you will have only 1 coconut supernova per couple hundred electron captured supernova. So the ratio is totally different. Another thing is that at least half of electron capture neutron stars is formed during the first half of the year. Well, it's this epoch is a bit bigger than for Cochrane's neutron stars, but still at the very beginning. And after that, it's almost flattened and it goes. It's still electron capture supernova, but maybe accretion gives collapse and merge gives collapse. And this rate is almost flat for the time. So what it gives us, that we actually can try to find out whether we have young pulsars and golden clusters. So the point, the difference between the young pulsars and the second pulsars is in the magnetic field, right? So the young pulsars have high magnetic field, the second pulsars have slow damped magnetic field. And accordingly, the lifetimes are different. Once you have a low magnetic field, your spinning down time is in much, much longer. It's about 10 to 11 to 30 years. And for young pulsars with a high magnetic field, the lifetime is about 10 to 8 years. So if you have some formation rate on your theory of electron capture supernova neutron stars, so then you just multiply that number on your lifetime, and then you have some expected number of young pulsars in global clusters. There are just a few. And indeed, at least a few are observed. It's 3 young, high magnetic field pulsars in 3 different clusters. And there is no any other channel that could explain to you the origin of those young pulsars. We don't expect co-collapse supernova to happen at this age. And the ages are from 7 to 10 to 8 years. So they did from very recently. Merger-induced collapse pulsars will have much higher magnetic field. We expect them to become magnetars, or also known as anomalous X-ray pulsars. Very lifetime, even shorter by 100 of 100 times compared to the young pulsars. And we don't see any in all global clusters, that is completely consistent with the formation rates. And but it was one in this one fund, so it's not exactly about the global cluster because it's a young superstar cluster. Okay, so now I will a little bit elaborate on the.
The Wesselin one.
Yes.
Is that cluster even old enough to have formed white dwarfs yet? So when you say merger induced, what merger between?
No, I said that we don't see accretion, we don't see NMR6 surpluses. Not all NMR6 surpluses will necessarily come from merger induced collapse, but merger induced collapse maybe will lead to formation of accretion or for ASPs. You see? So the fact that we don't see HP in all global clusters mm-hmm. is consistent with having slow rate of merger induced collapse.
Yeah, okay. Countries. Okay.
But seeing a young ASP in the young superstar cluster just say nothing.
Okay.
So here is a distribution of global clusters in our galaxy over the Middle East. So if you put on the spot X-ray binaries, bright X-ray binaries, you know, just will put some in this region subgiants, some in this region main sequence containers, and here with the topics, you will have one in level rich, one in level proof. You will have roughly fair distribution of X-ray binaries, and you will have one not exactly identified. Grand surveillance, we still don't know whether it's critical or in sequence. And we have a clustering of identifying in sequence binaries in the middle of region. From my own cluster simulations, I know that the channels which could produce a main sequence neutron star binary, low mass extra binary, are varied. They could be from single star interactions, they in big numbers come from binary exchanges. So it's a complicated thing which really depends on your initial assumptions. Higher complex binaries is a more proper thing. Mostly, all of them come from physical collisions. Yes, there is indeed some small fraction which could come from binary exchanges, but once you just a little, but it's only in the case of 100% initial binary fraction. Once you just dip it down, this fraction is almost gone. So these stars come from single star interaction, neutron star and the red giant. So both populations are pretty well defined at a given age in the masses and almost in the gradient, because it will just integrate the average cross-section for a red giant for the given. And also, ultra-complex binaries are very convenient in the sense that you very well know the lifetime of this persistent binary. And when we say a bright X-ray binary for ARM, normally it means that it's about 10 and 36 stars per second. Okay. So this corresponds to about 7 and 8 years. So this is for lifetime. Okay, so you know, you can find a formation rate of ultra-complex X-ray binaries per number of neutron stars, or like per one neutron star in the global clusters, as a function of dynamical conditions in global clusters, the fraction of regents, which actually can be easily defined, well, almost easy, found for the current age. Basically this is it. So it's pretty easy. You find the minimum number of feature competency variants which you expect, assuming that for example, 300 neutron stars per typical cluster. You can just change it to the one neutron star and just find the formation rate of feature competency variants per one neutron star. And then compare those numbers with clusters where the ultra complex variants have been observed. So when you plug in the numbers, so here are six clusters with observed bright complex binaries. And here are the numbers which are from this single analytics are expected. So this, and this cluster are in a pretty good agreement. This cluster is known to be type of disrupted. This cluster is known to be to have poorly known dynamical parameters. And this one is disrupted by a very high level. So I don't really care about those three. And the good thing is that the 47 type doesn't have one, and it doesn't have one. So it's sort of consistent with the number of observed ultra-complex binaries is consistent with the number of neutron stars which you expect to be retained from our theory about how neutron stars
are.
Each of these clusters has one?
Yes.
Except 47 type.
Yes, the 47 type doesn't have one. And yeah, it's completely, it's a cluster where you should sort of relatively well because the dynamic of them is also I just want to make a comment. So the number of Michelin stars for global clusters are based on the assumption that there was no tidal mass loss. It's just a stellar limit mass loss from the global cluster. There was no any other significant mass loss event in the life of the global cluster.
Very quickly, what is only non-dynamical parameters for 6652? What is what you can constrain very well? The velocity or?
I think mass. And the density.
Is it heavily reddened in the center?
I don't remember.
Usually when it's around 6,000 it is, but
So you've done this test only for the ones in which you've actually seen ultracarbon. I'm kind of confused. So
yeah, this is the real test. Yes. Okay. So
the real test is you have to look at all the other ones and predict them.
In the paper we did the test on the every single global cluster. Okay. So then we find out that it's also consistent. But with a simple analysis, it's just easy to show you do the numbers that you just can plug in a simple formula. The funny thing is that the simulations which we do with our 100% whatever line reflection, but it doesn't matter because it's in the same story. Collisions, it comes out with comparable expected numbers for ultra complex rebinders. If you plug in everything what you get from dynamical simulations.
That can't be right. There are other clusters which have similar dynamical states as the one there, which basically don't have ultra complex.
I'll show you, okay? You come in with the name, I'll show you the line, okay?
The relevance of the entirely disruptive comment is because if the cluster has lost a significant fraction of its mass,
it means that we do not have a good handle on the number of neutron stars. Because the neutron stars, especially cold collapse, well, and even accretion disk collapse, are being formed in big numbers during the first degree. If the cluster was slightly disrupted after that, it kept the same number of neutron stars, but its mass is not wrong. So
when you look at the current mass, you don't have a good
idea
of the population from which your neutron star might have
formed.
Yeah. You're saying the 6712 had an original mass of 10 to the 7, is that right?
Yeah. It has an inverse mass function. Okay, so just points to make so far. So we expect that both co-collapse and electron capture supernova contributing in the neutron star production. Electron capture supernova production now in the current epoch is sort of consistent with observations and to explain the observed number of young pulsars. And the total number of retained neutron stars, which is about a couple of hundred per what they call as a typical dense cluster with the current mass of 200,000 solar masses, is consistent with the number of ultra-complex rebinders in Milky Way global clusters. So why am I making those points? Actually, by this moment, I was expecting that this 5 minutes ago, Fred will come up with a comment which will be exactly about my next slide because it was used to like his over conference. But for some reason, he's slow. Okay. So let's
pay attention now.
Okay, so what would happen if the cluster been really with multiple populations? So now you understand my questions. Okay, so multiple population means that it was 10 times more massive. And 10 times more massive, it's not only the total mass, it's also the escape velocity was about 3 times bigger.
No, that's not necessary.
Not necessary.
It's, you can do, but it's not necessary for this scenario. But I'm not saying that you're up. I'm just saying that you have to keep the same radius and increase the mass.
Yeah, but if you keep the same radius and increase the mass and escape velocity, it changes back up to 3.
Yeah. But you don't need to keep the same radius. That's what I'm saying. I'm just saying that it's not.
The change in the escape velocity doesn't really play significant role, but anyway. So assuming the escape velocity was changed by 3 times, then from cold collapse supernova, it will be produced 30,000 neutron stars,
with monocrystal will be retained, and then the four clusters supernova will be 5,000, and all of them will be retained, which means that typical global cluster now will have about 6,000 neutron stars, which is 20 times more than the dark matter generation. So let's try to look on those multiple population global clusters. So two of them indeed have a bright element Z, but those global clusters have the same collision number as other global clusters, which also have bright element Z. And here are other multiple population global clusters which do not have bright element
Z. Wait, are we counting 47 Tuck as a multiple population cluster?
Yeah, it was told that it's almost multiple.
It's NGC-104, by the way.
That's what Jamal
says, that it has a spread on its main sequence which is more than photometric error and not asymmetric to the red side, so it's not binary.
Yeah, I remember this from the conference, and it was a hundredth of a magnitude or something, really small.
It's not a multiple population.
Yeah.
It's not like that.
And he claims it's got a spread or maybe two subgiant branches.
But there's no PHP.
Well, it has no PHP. What is settled up here doesn't really change the picture, because actually the test was considered that without 47 type, it didn't compare to 47 type, because 47 type at least have 23 millisecond pulses. But the other highlighted with yellow global clusters, they are at least as massive as 47 type. They are at least as dense. And they don't vary well. So one of them has also 5 cooling Zs, not knowing yet about 27 pulses, 22 away here. One cooling Z, and so this one doesn't have any. So I doubt they could have 20 times more neutron stars, or all those neutron stars have to be lost during
that's
this
exactly. So, I mean, you cannot get any constraint on the population from this. Number one, because as I said, the escape velocity is not required to be as high. Less we have
the
escape velocity must be such that we retain HB width.
Yeah,
not,
instead of 6,000, it will be 5,000. The escape velocity doesn't change much.
But so you are not. And the second point is when we say that you have to lose 90% of the mass, we are not retaining neutron stars preferentially. So we are losing 90% including.
Because the relaxation time is long
it's
compared to
not
the time scale.
The relaxation process. The mass loss of the 90% of the first generation star is not driven, cannot be driven by two-body relaxation. So you have no preferential retention of neutron stars.
Unless you have primordial mass segregation.
That's
you take those neutron stars and make a Quinlan Shapiro instability.
Or you have
a dark
matter. These are the INDH, they go in black hole too. They make it quickly, make it massive enough, and I can go yours. These are the INDH clusters.
That's all.
Anyway, so all first generation must be lost, like that's what happens in our. We don't have any preferential loss of low mass stars. It's just streaking off for most of the layers. So that's what we see now. So
could you go back to slide? So you said that all of your electron capture supernovae are retained?
At 100 kilometers per second, yes, almost all.
That's right, 20%.
Well, it's flats, it's copper flats, so it's whole neutron stars, so it's will be 20% from the whole.
Okay, the whole population.
Yes.
Right.
So, sorry, which model are you using? Which escape velocity are you using for this?
For the 5,100? That's much bigger than one year in our model.
It doesn't matter, anywhere from 55 to 100.
Okay, that's still so, well, even if you just multiply it, well, you'll have at least 3,000.
Sorry?
Well, if you just multiply it, you'll
have 3,000. You just need to retain units which are about 1,000% or less. That's how it's running. So,
no, I mean, the typical global cluster will retain 300.
You
have a 10 times more massive global cluster.
But you're losing 90% of the mass, including the new.
Yeah,
mass loss is not, let me reemphasize it, it's two-body relaxation driven. You are going to lose 0.1, 0.2.
I see your point, and you say that it is in your core.
You're agreeing with each other. It's okay.
Okay. Well, it didn't look like that. But that's fine. I like to do that.
But you have short time scales involved potentially. How about the stellar black holes? Those are going to mass segregate like crazy. Would you get rid of those two?
They're not necessarily that way. And so, again, initial segregation.
It's
initial density.
Depends on the relaxation time compared to the dissolution time. It must be.
What was your maximum mass when you ran the simulation?
Sorry?
What was the maximum stellar mass?
Well, in the simulation, for the first simulation, we had
0.1. So you did form the black holes. And so they also did lots of the same.
As I said, those are clusters which
without the situation
we got. So it's mostly
you preserve the second generation and part of the third generation, but
you don't have any preferential loss of low mass stars, right?
So all the mass loss happens before any significant mass segregation, is basically what you're saying.
No, we have some mass segregation, but it's a quick expansion of the cluster. So yes, you might have a slight preferential retention of
some
of
the cool stuff.
But you also have what's
also from the stars. Massive, very massive stars closer to the center.
Yeah. But actually, you think that this is happening when there are still more solar mass AGB stars.
Trigger the expansion, actually. So,
Enrico, does this make any prediction for intergalactic globules?
Sorry?
There's a handful of known intergalactic globules. Mm-hmm. Three titanium and contaminated there.
Mm-hmm.
Few of the kiloparsecs, many things. But will this scenario make any sort of predictions?
Well, that's related. Your question is related. Okay, are you going to lose the first generation or not? If you don't have a tidal location, your cluster is going to expand.
They don't look like that.
Would you see them? Did these minor steps points?
If you got the integrated light, you'd be able to see.
More color, if you want to
I don't know about the structure parameters of it. You don't know where they form in a galaxy and then they were stressed. So you're assuming that they formed there.
We have some idea. They look like they formed in the outskirts of low mass spirals. Like if you look at the colors.
It's always a matter of what was their size compared to the tidal radius when they formed. That's what is important,
really?
Since this must be relatively rapid mass loss through the tidal body. So if when they formed, let's say, 30 kpc from a spiral, they were more or less filling the tidal kpc.
Which ones are you talking about, the outer? I'm a little confused. I thought you saw some in the vertigo in the middle of the field. You couldn't really associate them with the outer region of the spirals.
No, we went back up where they came from. So what we know about the character.
And it's based on the metallicity mostly that you're saying this?
Yeah, that's we didn't dig them out of the giant elliptical. And they probably didn't come from.
How do you actually know you didn't? Because there's what metallicity is, what colors?
They're not put the paper.
That's
more data, and we have some more data against this also.
Based on colors, I would say it's very iffy.
This is Williams and Cherdulo and those guys?
Me.
And you, okay. So you reduced the data thing?
I think I managed to delete it a couple of times. I thought you were talking about reduction.
Okay. Thank you.